Hey folks, welcome to the Unsung Podcast. It's just Chris and I today.
Yeah, whittled down to our essentials.
The essential components of this podcast.
This is what really counts.
It doesn't it?
Your Vicky overtone singing. can he do it this week?
Unfortunately not. You've been getting some nice comments about her being on the pod recently, which is quite nice to hear.
Shite when you bring somebody in and they totally overshadow you is what I was going to say. And you're like, you bring someone in and everyone's like, oh, I really get that girl you've got in the podcast. She's really taking up a notch. I'm like, hey, thanks.
I actually seen Weaver today. He's probably not listening. I don't know if he listens. Does he listen? I doubt he listens. I saw him.
Did he listen when he was on the show?
Nah. Yeah, he listens to the ones he wasn't on. He's a busy man. He's married and got dog and stuff.
I'm sure there's plenty of married people out there that are going around, doesn't really. I mean, I just sit about. But yeah, you know, we'll give him benefit of the doubt. I've not seen him in a while, but I do hear from him, and he does drop plenty of contentious links into the group chat.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite a week for that.
Yeah.
How's your week been?
It's been fairly non-eventful. Yeah, I can't really say very much. It's not done very much. I did lights and sound for a production of Twelfth Night. You know, the Shakespeare play.
Yep,
that was fun. Enjoyed that.
I mean, imagine most people listening didn't do that this week. So that's worth mentioning.
It was it's a romantic comedy, and it's much funnier when you see it performed than when you read it. So that was nice to see. So.
Good for you. Good for you.
What about you, Christopher?
I enjoyed being gaslit by my national football team this week. That was good. Scotland went and inexplicably won against both Republic of Ireland and Ukraine.
Mm.
And it's all it does is make it all the more painful later on.
Yeah, it prolongs the misery somewhat, right?
Because they'll wait for a moment when it's really crucial, like they did this summer, and then they won't win. And you're like, why do you constantly do this?
Yeah.
It's a cycle of emotional violence. But that was entertaining. Talking to Ukraine, also watched Noam Chomsky making a cunt of himself on Owen Jones.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Aye, he's not really figured out what's going on in Ukraine, apparently, but
he
has loud opinions on it. He's still sharp, man. He was 93 years old, still sharp, but he's just too fucking married to that Noam Chomsky brand, isn't it? It's like, so
all those things can be true.
Aye, like millions of Ukrainians, let's not listen to them.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so politics aside.
Actually, not politics aside, I was just thinking earlier on, this could be the last podcast we ever do.
We've said that before, I'm sure.
It looks increasingly likely at this point, no?
I do believe there was a podcast a couple of years ago where nuclear conflict was an issue. Was it not around about the time of Kim throwing things about as well?
Yeah, but this is a lot more likely at this point, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll see.
That's all we can really. Nobody fucking knows what's going to happen.
Yeah. Fuck you, Connie Day, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like we can just stomp in there and like separate them like two guys in a bar fight. Nor should we. We should be waiting in there and knocking fuck out of that wee prick. So, I don't know. What are you going to do, man? I mean, these are weird times. All you can do is stick on a record from the late 90s and talk about it for an hour and a half.
Yeah, that's what we're going to do. Before we go do that, though. It's almost record club time again. We're still looking for new subs. We've got some new records. What do you mean by record club, Chris? What is that?
The record club is a thing we do to try and get money out of people. Oh, no, to try and spread the word on really good albums.
That's the one.
Rather than just subscribing like your typical boring podcast, you can subscribe at a higher level and we will send you curated albums based on your taste, based on your preferences each month, and money goes to the artist and we keep the rest, and it funds the podcast and it funds the artists, and you get limited edition copies of really good albums that we've spent a lot of time sourcing and, you know, collating in one place. And yeah, we think it's really worthwhile. If you're not doing it, I mean, can you really call yourself a good person?
Yeah, I mean, you can listen to those records on Spotify or Apple Music or whatever. Sure, you totally can. But you know, as well as we know, that they're getting no money for that.
Yeah.
In this case, they get some money, so.
Yeah. Give it a shot. If you want to just subscribe at a low level, that'd be nice as well. We've been doing a lot of work for this for a long time. Mm-hmm. And
it's 5 years in a couple of months.
Yeah, it wouldn't hurt to get a bit of cash so we could put a bit more time into it and a bit less time doing the mines.
Doing the mines.
Yeah.
Speaking of doing the mines.
North of England?
North of England.
North of England, right.
Is it Nottingham? It's Nottingham.
No, it's Northumberland.
Is it?
Yeah, it's Northumberland.
They all begin to N, right?
Nice try. So when we started Unsung, there were a handful of albums that I had in the back of my head, and this is one of them. This has been hanging about for a long time for me because it's probably one of the most enduring records that I've owned, which I did not see coming at the time, especially from a band that at best I had a sort of passing interest in. It is Diskin by The Drum. Mm-hmm. Technically, this week's band is The Drum, not China Drum, but it is also China Drum, because reasons that will become apparent as we go through this. It's worth mentioning up front, we actually got in touch with the band, we got in touch with Adam Lee, as it turns out, just to try and clear up a couple of things about the lore of the band. You know, there's different versions and accounts and theories out there about quite why this album sounds the way it does, which is totally different to the rest of their catalogue, and, you know, the name change and everything about it. So, yeah, Adam was really nice. He was really responsive, got back to us quickly so we could include it in the show. And, we'll drop what we learned into it, like primary research, the hallmark of any good documentary.
Mm-hmm. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about China Drum then? The Drum, China Drum?
China Drum, formed in 1989 in Ovingham-upon-Tyne, which is a wee town about 50 miles south of the Scottish border. They had three studio albums, one proper EP, and a whole host of singles, and they actually continue to release tracks to this day, albeit with a kind of slightly changed lineup. The original lineup was Adam Lee, the aforementioned Adam Lee, who played drums and sang.
Mm-hmm. Very rare, that
singing drummer. We'll come back to that, but have we featured many of them in the show?
No, and not as a primary vocalist, at least, anyway.
We've mentioned Queen in passing, and I suppose Roger Taylor counts on occasion, but not many others.
I don't think a sound man's going to be raging at Roger Taylor. I think a sound man's going to be raging at this guy for singing and playing drums.
Talking about Queen, Bill McQueen. On guitar and Dave McQueen on bass, brothers. How does it go when you start a band with your brother?
Yeah, I didn't start a band with my brother, I just asked him to come and join my band.
How did that go?
It's been alright so far. I can tell him to fuck off, which is nice.
It must
which you want to do sometimes in bands,
so. That is one of the things in bands, a lack of plain talking and constructive criticism. So what choices they got. The group added Jan Alkema on drums in 1998. Jan was kind of added to the lineup to let Adam do frontman duties, effectively, for the Self-Made Maniac tour, their second album, but became a full member soon after. They then became The Drum in 1998, after Jan had joined permanently. They disbanded, or I will say it's a retrospective hiatus, in September 2000. You know, if they disbanded at the time, but then it turns out it wasn't permanent, are we allowed to just rechristen it a hiatus? I think perhaps.
Perhaps.
They reformed, or ended, the hiatus.
Yeah, hiatus came to an end, yeah.
In 2013, with the addition of John Steele on second guitar and Kate Stevenson on drums. Jan had obviously left by that point, although it seems like they're all still on good terms. And Bill McQueen ended up stepping away in 2014, and they continued as a quartet. So Adam and Dave are still in there from the original lineup. As I say, judging from back and forth online, the members and ex-members seem to chip in online pretty regularly. It seems like relations within the previous membership seem pretty good, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to see.
Yeah.
You fucking love to see that.
Yeah, totally, man.
No faith no more here.
Yeah, it's heartening to see that, you know, people have lives, man. When you leave a band, it doesn't have to be the end of the world, or when you get asked to leave a band sometimes, it doesn't have to be the end of a relationship. I think for a lot of people it is, because egos are so big and tied up in this shit, you know what I mean? Because you feel so precious about the stuff you've created. But, you know, we've both been in situations where we've had to let people go, or even we've been asked to leave bands. It doesn't really make much difference.
I've never been asked to leave a band.
Neither have I, but I'm just trying to account for other people.
I pity the fool. Okay, some musical comparisons. I'm going to throw Mega City 4. Therapy, Group Dog Drill, who I think they were quite friendly with, Curb Dog, although I'll caveat that by saying the later stuff on the Turn album, and then Wilt, the band that Cormac Battle did afterwards.
Yeah,
three colours red, I suppose. And then across the Atlantic, a really obvious touchstone is Husker Du, or Husker Du, Sugar, Bob Mould, that kind of school. Again, a band that they have posted about on their social media quite a bit, especially Copper Blue, the Sugar album. Bands they reference, the band are big Wire fans. Again, that's coming off their Facebook. And I think it really shows, I think Diskin, in its sonic adventures, is somewhere between their 154 and their Manscape in terms of Wire. Because Wire were another band that had a certain style, had their trilogy, and then suddenly they started doing all this mad shit. The thing is, the drum pulled back from that, whereas Wire sort of continued that foray through the 80s with, you know, varying degrees of success. As I say, they're big fans of Sugar and Bob Mould, spoken about them a lot. Adam has also said in interviews that Inflammable Material by Stiff Little Fingers changed his life. I think at one point he actually met, is it Jake Burns, Stiff Little Fingers? And Jake Burns said that China Drum sounded like Green Day, which I think was a bit of a backhanded compliment. Adam's also said that I think Mush by Leatherface was one of the band's favourite records from their way on tour. Sticking it on quite frequently, especially.
Don't really sound like Leatherface, to be honest.
But they were big fans. I think also they were on tour with Ash, and they're fans of them as well. Leatherface actually covered a really early China Drum tune called Meaning on one of their own singles for a B-side. To give you a little bit of context and backdrop as to why it's getting mentioned, my first proper gig outside of Stirling, so I'm from Stirling, and that is it's not an insignificant little town.
It's a city.
Well, it's a city now, but that's about a fucking farce, isn't it? it's not insignificant. Braveheart, embarrassing statue of Mel Gibson / William Wallace, which has now been taken down, by the way. It's got a castle, it's got a monument that is like a giant phallus fucking the sky. We all love it. But it's not got a lot of music happening. But you could see the occasional local gig. However, my first foray to the big smoke was to see China Drum at King Tut's, which used to be a good venue in Glasgow. It is still there. Enough said. I think I was maybe about 98. I was too young to be in the bar, but since when did that matter? It was largely as well because of a certain song that they covered, which we'll discuss shortly. And it was with my good friend John Ross, who has been mentioned on a previous podcast because he's the owner of the Big Country Guitar, if you remember that one.
Callback.
Callback.
Great episodes.
Really good episodes. I was asked this the other day, like, what's your most popular episode? And I was like, I think generally the episode that's received the best critical response is probably Big Country. Parts A and B.
By Scots people.
Yeah. Anyway, the band also did a lot of shows up here. Just generally, they played Sleazy's, and I think they were also supported by Cable. Former subject of the show in another good episode at the Cat House, maybe around about 96, something like that. Being honest, whilst I quite liked China Drum, they didn't make a huge impact on me until Diskin, until they became The Drum. It's given the kind of sea of Brit rock that existed across that span from the mid-90s to the early 2000s. Early on, they had some decent support from influential DJs in the UK. Steve Lamacq, he's quoted as saying something about the China Drum t-shirt that said, "We play both kinds of music, punk and rock." John Peel, notably, played their self-released debut single, Simple, way back in 1993. That was their first release. He would then play further material from the group, including the video Barrier. He curated like an episode of 120 Minutes on MTV and he played that on it, which was good. What I don't understand about John Peel's relationship with the band is that he seemed to lose interest in them from discing. And given his famed kind of open-mindedness for bands that were pushing boundaries, I just don't get that. It's it wrong, John. I just don't understand why he didn't click with this album. But, you know, there you go. Finding them online, as you probably noticed in your research for this, isn't the easiest. China Drum kind of peaked at a period just prior to magazines moving online. And a lot of their articles and coverage didn't really make the transition. They weren't big enough, really, for fans to do this mass kind of export of stuff where it's like, you know, kind of crowdsourced.
Yeah,
But also a lot of the magazines just didn't do that. I suppose you can probably still go back and search digital editions, scans of the magazines and find them, but it's very time consuming to do that. In terms of just sort of search engineing them, it's not that easy to track stuff down about them. And it's even fucking harder when they transition to the drum, which is just not SEO friendly, guys. For fuck's sake. Look forward in time, please, and be considerate of us researchers. You can still find an interview that Adam did with Lollipop magazine, though, which yields some interesting stuff. He talks about various things. One of them is about small town musician life, something I can relate to. He says, "We didn't grow up in a scene. There wasn't really anything to look to. I can safely say we were the best band to come out of our town because we were the only band to come out of our town. The options were go to school, be a farmer, or get a job in the nearest big town, which was Newcastle, and become a bank clerk, a lawyer, or become involved in the shop system. Those were your choices. Or you start thieving cars. That's very big in Newcastle. Or you could get a job in the toilet roll factory across the river from where we lived." The band apocryphally rehearsed in a converted pig shed that was freezing all winter and roasted in summer, described themselves for a while as pig shed punk. By the way, Backlash Brewery, in based in Northumberland, I don't know if it's still going, but had a bitter called Self-Made Maniac.
Oh, nice.
And the label for it used a variation of the album art.
That's cool.
Adam spoke a bit about drumming and singing, a controversial topic. If you're a sound engineer, the secret, if I dare give it away, is to not think about what you're doing. If you think about what you're doing, you screw up. In the studio, when I was laying down the drum parts, I was still singing. Only guide vocals, but I have to sing along. Then when we went back and recorded vocals properly in the singing booth, luckily the lights were off so no one could see me making a complete tit of myself. He was also asked if they ever recorded stuff on the records that they then couldn't do live, and he said flatly no, they would only record things that they could actually also perform. On lyrics, a contentious issue for me with this band, he says, "The songs are very personal. They're either about things we've been through or things we've thought about or things people we've known have done or gone through. We don't write political songs because we don't know enough about politics. It'd be hard for us to get it across on stage or on record unless we knew the subject well." Now, I'm going to be blunt, and there's a fair chance that at least one of the members of China Drum might listen to this show. It's because we made contact with them.
They're expecting it now.
On the second album in particular, Self-Made Maniac, the lyrics drive me mental.
Yeah, there's some egregious lyrics on that record.
I think they kind of quite obviously been written elsewhere, externally, you know, in a notepad sort of vibe, and then worked into the song structure. And it just sometimes feels so fucking clunky as a result. For me, the whole lyrical approach works far better in discing, where the strange arrangements marry far better with those kind of obtuse phrases and also the more varied delivery. I think the way that they're delivered, the kind of muttering and all that kind of stuff, it's really, really interesting. The band played together for almost 4 years before they actually recorded. They didn't get around to making their first recording until 93, which was that self-financed Simple single. It was pressed into, it was just a few hundred copies of CDs and sold out pretty quickly, pushed along with aid for the likes of John Peel and Steve Lamack. You can also see cassette versions of it online. There's photos of it from like old school fans, which I believe the band kind of all made by hand. The first few years of their activity were documented by a series of singles that were later kind of largely collated into the Barrier EP. That includes Simple for 93, Great Fire in 94. Pictures in 95. The EP was released via Mantra in the UK and Europe, which I think was part of the Beggars group.
Yeah.
And then 510 Records, which was a subsidiary of MCA, New Music Corporation of America, unsurprisingly, in the USA.
Mm-hmm.
In 1994, they did a split EP with a punk band called The Flying Medallions for Fierce Panda, and China Drum's contribution to that was a cover of Wuthering Heights. Fairly well-known song by Kate Bush. Very fucking good cover. Something that we've mentioned on the show before, we actually did a cover version mixtape where that ranked really highly in the discussion, and it's also just cropped up as just general bangers in mm-hmm. conversations in the Christmas episodes. That cover eventually brought them to a lot of people's attention. That was actually the reason I ended up at that show in Glasgow. And it was later voted the 15th best cover of all time in a BBC Radio 6 poll. By the way, Pet Shop Boys won that poll. And no, it wasn't Go West by the Village People. It was Always On My Mind by Elvis. And I'm kind of with that.
That's a great cover.
Because that is a phenomenal cover. Mm-hmm. Video is shit. Cover is fantastic.
That was actually the first time I heard that song. I think my mum playing it on a probably a Now CD or something like that. It's the first time I'd ever heard that song before I'd even heard Elvis. That was when I was so young.
I mean, the Elvis version is great.
Yeah.
You see that bam, ba-da-da-dam, bam, bam. I mean, that's just not there in the original. Mm-hmm. It's fucking great. Anyway, not to get too sidetracked, Adam spoke a bit about Wuthering Heights, the reasons for it. He said, I'm going to really irritate you with my answer when he was asked why that song. I don't know. I've always wanted to say that in an interview. Actually, Bill and I both have that Kate Bush album, so he was just playing it and we all joined in. It just sounded amazing when it was pumped up, so we decided to record it. It's such a good song. We wish we'd written it. We sent a copy to Kate Bush, but we didn't hear back from her. We did actually play it at the Whiskey Club in LA, and our manager was there, and he said it was a compliment to her, so we were pleased.
Mm-hmm.
Now, China Drum actually got some pretty fucking good shows.
In
1995, they got a tour with Green Day. I mean, Green Day in 1995 were fucking thermonuclear huge.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse the thermonuclear triggering thing there.
And also, I don't know, like, I think it was a few months ago, or maybe last year now, I can't remember, but they released a bunch of BBC sessions. All the stuff they'd done at Made a Veil, and it was from the 90s. Like, they were unbelievably tight. It's like scary how good they were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know it's only three guys and it's not exactly the hardest music to play, but it's not perfect, and that's, they were untouchable in that era.
Well, alongside the tour with Green Day, they also toured with Ash, who were pretty huge then as well.
Also pretty untouchable live at that point too.
Mm-hmm. And Supergrass, also pretty fucking huge. These are like really good shows. And actually, I kind of quite like all those bands as well. I know we're kind of on the fence about Ash, but you know, at that point, I loved them.
In that era, they were great.
95 got them a really good show at the Reading Festival as well. Mike Durnt from Green Day was seen wearing a China Drum shirt in the video for When I Come Around. Mm-hmm. If you notice that when they're walking down the street, that's what his shirt says. 1996, they brought out their first album, Goose Fair, which caused quite a stir. The lead single, I Can't Stop These Things, featured Wuthering Heights as a B-side, and I mean, arguably that got as much, if not more, attention than the main song. And Wuthering Heights was also on the album as a secret track 25 minutes after the end. Again, Adam, talking to Lollipop magazine, was asked about that. He said, "I'll tell you why it is. If you fall asleep really drunk while listening to the CD, it'll give you a heart attack when the song comes on. We just really didn't want to be labelled a cover band. We didn't want to make a name for ourselves as the band that covered Kate Bush's Wuthering Heights. We did want to put it on the album, but we didn't want it to be a major part of the album." And I kind of see the logic in that. It's good.
Yeah, songs not even on Spotify. The only version of it is on that album. You know, there is no like singles. There's no singles on Spotify or anything like that of B-sides and stuff. So,
what did you think of Goose Fair?
Fine.
Fine. I mean, it's much simpler prospect. I mean, it's a three-piece band doing melodic sort of British punky rock. It's not out and out punk rock.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard them described as pop punk, and I don't think I'd really put them in that category, to be honest.
At times.
I don't really think it's that. Alt rock is probably closer, to be honest. It's like label and Ash pop punk. They kind of are, but they're not really. Yeah. You know, I thought it was fine. Like, I find the vocal quite annoying, if I'm totally honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like you say, it doesn't really deviate. And that's not, like, he's got a good voice, don't get me wrong. And I'd often wonder if there's part of that is to do with drumming as well.
Yeah.
As a singer, generally, it's quite difficult, you know, to be, like, to do complicated vocal things and get them right live, you know. You want to make it as easy for yourself as possible, hence why a lot of punk bands have really simple melodies and stuff, because they focus on getting that across. But Can't Stop These Things is a good song. Also really liked Fell Into Place. If we talk, we're gonna stay here on the shelf. That's where I should be, looking down at you, making promises like politicians do. Meaning's okay as well. That's the one that was that the one Leatherface covered?
Yeah, that's the one.
I think it was. Yeah. Even I could be pretentious. Even I can give it me. It's a good song.
That had been a B-side on their very first thing, and they must have redone it.
It does feel much closer to that American alt-rock vibe in that era, you know?
Yeah.
Which is fine, but just a lot of punk bands, my favourite punk bands, they have some kind of complexity in them, be it like a melodic vocal or, you know, a nicely arranged guitar and bass part or whatever, or even drums. A lot of times it's drums. They're all these guys are all great players with some good ideas, but it never really pulls together in a way it's engaging for me.
Yeah, you know? I don't fall out with it. I mean, it's very of the time, and it certainly has nothing even approaching the lasting power for me of what they went on to do. Now, shortly after, I think it was August of 1996, China Drum became the first British band to play Sarajevo.
Wow.
Following the end of the siege. It was at the Cuck Club or Cook Club. Cuck Club has other connotations, I guess. Second band, by the way, to play Sarajevo is Dodgy.
But who's booking these two?
Well, apparently they made arrangements via the army, who actually helped them ship the gear over. They had like loads of stuff. It was a deliberate attempt, obviously, to show support and try and bring some normality back to the people of Bosnia-Herzegovina. They released the Wipeout single in 1996. I actually quite liked that song. Now, I can't remember where it was I came across it. I don't think it was the single. I think it either appeared in a compilation or a cover mount CD somewhere. But it's a bit harder and a bit darker than much of the earlier stuff. It's was it maybe Metal Hammer, something like that. Anyway, cool tune, bit more sinister. And then they followed that in 1998 with Self-Made Maniac, their second album. Again, talking about covers, Fiction of Life, the single off of this, features a cover of Crowded House's Fall at Your Feet.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just go. I'll be waiting when you call. As I mentioned, the lyrics in this album sit badly with me. The Self-Made Maniac, for me, conforms to a lot of standards that were prevalent, especially in the UK scene at that time. And whilst I do think it's a respectable example of the rock climate, it is not exceptional. I wouldn't say it's up there even with some of the kind of Wild Heart stuff. Even like, you know, I didn't like Three Colours Red very much, but they made more of a splash, I think. Being very honest, I don't particularly like this record. Sorry guys if you're listening, I don't like this record. And ultimately, I think that might also be one reason I find Diskin and the push away from this sound so thrilling and relatable. Card-carrying China Drum fans love it, of course. Debate rages over which of those first two records is the best. Personally, I prefer Goose Fair to this. But if I had released Self-Made Maniac, I suspect I might have been stricken with that same restlessness that brought about the experimentation of Diskin. It's a respectable album, especially in context of the scene, but it's going nowhere. You know, it's a good example of British rock music, but where do you go from there? Because it certainly, to me, hasn't lasted now. I'm sure loads of people will disagree with me, and I don't mean any offence by that, but I'm just being honest. In terms of the tracks, one thing, it kind of kicks off the album with like a really down-the-line British alt-rock. Bothered sounds really like Cormac Battle wrote it, you know, Wilt or later Kerb Dog stuff. If you had a million people watching, would you make the same old blunder? Well, I wonder. Yes, I wonder. If I could put the words in writing, would you ever come? In fairness to China Drum, it isn't their fault that the sound became the sort of default for amateur rock bands for a decade thereafter. You could hear this kind of stuff in pubs everywhere. Now, they were at the start of that. People were effectively copying their ideas, but it did become that, and thus in hindsight is kind of tainted by that, you know. Somewhere Else is a strong flavour of Oasis to it, and I think could have almost been a crossover indie hit, a Britpop hit. Creeping over to you on a Saturday afternoon, I must have been ill, I was ill. And as I mentioned, you know, Fiction of Life, that tune, to me, legitimately does sound like Kerplunk era Green Day. I've been expecting a break out from a cage full of rage, but I haven't got the time to hold them back with my black jacket. I've become a self-made maniac. I've seen the bloodstains. I think the saving grace on that tune, and something that's I think is really interesting and worth mentioning, is that the chorus has this sudden inclusion of this much harder barked vocal that is, it's sunk way down in the mix. And in that one moment, I think you can really hear the seeds of what was going to happen on Diskin. Because it's not a sound that I'd heard them do prior. It just appears and you're like, oh, where's that coming from? Now, to skip on, since then, there haven't been any full-length records. The band resumed service under China Drum from 2013. And what I think was maybe a double A-side of the track Water and Kitty's Burn came out in 2014. Again, I think through the Two Pure Records Singles Club. We've mentioned that before in relation to McCluskey and PJ Harvey. Water had been a B-side and had also made an appearance on the Japanese expanded edition of Diskin in 2000. Deeper, but they re-recorded it with a new lineup. And Kitty's Burn is just a straight up cheery pop punk thing, very much underscoring the return to China Drum status. Wished I could be just where you are. They do still regularly release stuff through their Bandcamp.
Actually, this year, I think they released a new single in August.
Well, they've got two out. Yeah, they did. So chinadrum1.bandcamp.com, you can get a lot of stuff on that. Bonnie and Clyde came out earlier in the year. Ultra tuneful and upbeat, another reminder that it's definitely China Drum, not the Drum Territory. And Hurdy Gurdy was the one that came out in August. Playful, and it's even got like a hint of Afrobeat to it, that song, although there's plenty of like direct punk rock melody that ought to kind of keep them on the good side of the old school fans. So they're still a going concern with a new lineup with a four piece, and Diskin is just a weird one. It's a weird moment in the career of this band. I don't think many people saw coming. People had them pegged as something, and they did something totally off the wall. As to how that was received, let's talk about that.
The Drum.
The Diskin. Drum. Suddenly.
Yeah, suddenly. The Drum. Drum.
Diskin, 2000. I mean, immediately a useful word here is departure. This album sounds very little like the records that came before it.
Definitely.
Nor the singles that followed it, for what it's worth.
Sounds like a new band.
Exactly, yeah. The band suddenly changed its name and existing fans sort of sat up like meerkats. You know that thing? We're like, whoa, what the fuck? What are you doing? Messing with the formula. The name change seemed to reflect a new philosophy as well as representing that sort of distinct new sound. We actually asked Adam about this, and he said the name change was again for various reasons. We were already known affectionately as The Drum. It's a very northern thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The Drum.
Yeah.
We also had the addition of Jan as a writer, and also the style was quite a change, so we were pretty happy to change the name to The Drum, which I guess kind of makes sense. It wasn't some massive preconceived concept album thing, it just sort of happened but of its own accord. My personal recollection of this album coming out was one of a generally warm critical reception. I think it got 4Ks in Kerrang, and I seem to remember 8 out of 10 in one of the other publications. However, Enemy were famously negative about it. They give it 2.5 out of 5, and actually when you read the review, 2.5 sounds like more than the reviewer probably wanted to give it. The review was pretty scathing, included a few comparisons to Placebo, which I'm not sure I really get.
I can hear Placebo in this.
Yeah.
Not often, but there's some of it in there.
I mean, I guess Placebo did experiment a fair bit with production from, you know, Without You I'm Nothing album, you know, Pure Morning and stuff like that had a lot of experimentation with production, but that was released the same year. You couldn't very well suddenly hear that and want to rip it off or integrate it, you know, to an album that was basically finished at the same time as it. So I'm not sure there was a lot of that in Placebo prior to that, though. You know, saying that with hindsight, was there much in the first album? I don't think so. Anyway, Enemy had some of the following comments to say. Diskin sees them embrace a Molko-shaped tune here and there too. Horn's Front, for example, could be construed by the cynical among us as a complete bloody rip-off of the Squeaky Yank Sleaze Goblin sound. The Squeaky Yank Sleaze Goblin. What fucking editor let that one pass? Holy shit. But we forgive such flagrant sonic thievery because it remains a soaringly good tune. I mean, to fucking say that Horn's Front... Horn's Front is flagrant sonic thievery of Placebo is fucking absurd. But anyway, they go on, and boy do they go on. And also, because it's surrounded by a fair amount of complete shit too, there's a computer-generated tightness to the rhythm on these tracks, which suggests a decent future-facing attitude. That one phrase I do agree with, it suggests a decent future-facing attitude, but that's about it. But overlaid is the same old heaving guitar drone and alternately slacker mumbled psycho-screeching vocals. To me, that just is fucking nonsense. This album is strewn with a variety of guitar tones. In fact, if anything, you could say it's inconsistent in its guitar tones. They did so many different approaches to guitar process, and some of it sounds acoustic, some of it is saturated beyond fucking all recognition, some of it sounds like synths. To say that it's the, you know, the same old heaving guitar drone, I mean, fuck off, that's just lazy. Among the dross, which is a hell of a phrase, among the dross are genuinely abrasive moments like the sparse Biff Malibu and the slow burning guitar haze of The Beast, but crucially they're the songs where the drum turn the amps down low and slow the pace to a shuffle. They don't need to make a racket to have an impact. It's a lesson learned too late. I don't think that writer's on to much, frankly, and clearly my cards are on the table. I like this album, but I just don't even see a critique in there that you would say, ah, well, that's a fair point. Anyway, elsewhere, existing fans of the band also took the hump because they were experimenting with new sounds. Collins Punk Rock World said, it's not up there with their brilliant Goose Fair or the follow-up Self-Made Maniac. Well, I just don't agree with that on either.
Collins a good guy.
Count. Is he? Good old Colin, but he's rang. Rate Your Music, Trevor Machine said, the unfortunate product of China the Drum Drums' decision to indulge themselves and treat the studio as an instrument. Fuck's wrong with treating the studio as an instrument?
What's a studio for if not for treating it as an instrument?
My God, man, every album has to sound like the Ramones.
Imagine.
Even the fucking Ramones treated the studio. No. They weren't Phil Spector, for fuck's sake. Anyway, unfortunately, this is him, not me. Unfortunately, they made the cardinal and much repeated error of parking their arses behind the console before writing any decent tunes. A few clever tricks, there is little to nothing in the way of melody. On first spin, this CD seems abjectly tuneless. Here, the guitars have been detuned, digitised and deconstructed. These experiments needed great vocals over them to give them life and emotion, something that China Drum's vocalist was incredibly good at. On discing, he's conspicuous in his absence. The only solace is that I paid £2.50 for a mint copy. Pretty snide, but he's saying that he thought China Drum's vocals were excellent up until this point and not good from this point on. Personally, I think the exact opposite. I think the vocals before were totally fine. They were completely functional in a kind of British pop rocky band. He's a good singer without in any way being spectacular. On this record, they really fucked about with the delivery, and some of it I think is absolutely fucking inspired. I love the vocal use on this. What's your reaction to any of those critiques? I'll put a couple of good ones in a minute, but I'm curious about the criticisms.
The things like saying, you know, using the studio as an instrument, and I mean, it does feel as though to me that the record was assembled as opposed to written and recorded in the studio, that they'd done multiple takes and cut it together, but that's not a bad thing. this is like a completely like off the wall comparison, right? But come with me on this journey. Why Can't This Be Love by Van Halen was a jam that was then cut down and turned into a song. And it sounds perfectly cohesive. That's using the studio as an instrument, and that's I really like that song. It's a great song, and that's happened throughout history. Loads of bands, like the Beatles, famously doing that, like religiously. You know, they were one of the first to do it. So, if you don't like that kind of music, then fair enough. But I think if you're a fan of two records, and then this hits you, maybe the same thing happened to John Peel. To be honest, like, it's not what you expect, and your expectations, like, well, I don't want to engage with that because it's different, and don't really give it the time of day because it's not the band that they liked. If you come at those critiques from that point of view, then I guess that might seem fair to fans of the band. But I think if you take the discography as a whole, and obviously in hindsight, I think we're past all that kind of bullshit, to be honest.
Talking about John Peel, actually, I wish I knew how he felt about the album Heads Will Roll by The Fall, because I think there's a really interesting parallel here. John Peel fucking loved The Fall. Fucking couldn't get enough of The Fall. And when they brought that album out, the track Blindness on it in particular has a lot of similarities to stuff like The Beast on this, the ultra saturated tones and the really unusual production approach in it.
The flat is evil.
I wonder if John Peel warmed to that. Yeah, I still struggle to understand why he fell off the wagon here. But yeah, I mean, I reject a lot of what's in those critiques. It doesn't ring particularly true. There are some folk that got it though. Scruffy Theory has a thing called the Overlooked Classics series, which is pretty good. And as part of that, they said the influences on this record are much more diverse and interesting than the pop punk by numbers of their previous albums. Even now, 20 years on, I don't think I've ever heard anything quite like it.
That review also name checks Placebo as well.
Mm-hmm. But again, I think that's happening in hindsight, because if you look at the timelines, it's hard to imagine that they took too much from them. Rate Your Music, there's a reviewer called Rat Monkey. Mm-hmm. You always like to hear somebody called Rat Monkey praising your bands, don't you? A change of name and a change of approach with spectacular results, Rat Monkey says. Interestingly, Rat Monkey continued, having recruited Jan Alkema to take over on drums, singer Adam Lee was free to go out front, which made an enormous difference to their live shows, but brought with it new ideas, which ultimately led to a rift between Lee and the rest of the band, who were committed to a more complex and experimental sound. So what you see entering there is a kind of one of the theories that fans had about where did this all come from and why did the band suddenly break up and stuff. So again, I just asked Adam about this when we got a chance to talk to him, and he kind of quashed that, saying, I think speculation is the cause of many problems. We started writing and recording in a totally different way from the previous two albums. Firstly, we had an additional writer, Jan Alkema. He joined us. We had previously loved Compulsion, sorry, that's Jan's previous band, and had done many gigs with them. Also, we wanted to use the technology that was around at the time. So we were using SP-808 groove samplers, hard drive recorders, and nearly all the tunes were written on those machines, with a lot of editing and cut and paste options now being made readily available to us. We definitely wanted to explore and push ourselves to new, unexplored tunesmithing. We hit it head on. Our difficulties came from three of us having newborn families. We all suffered from tour fever, which was a hard thing to process personally. We changed management and we changed the name of the band, all of which, with a large dose of hindsight, I think could have been avoided. But we were all very pleased with the results of Diskin. I love to hear that, because, yeah, this idea that some of the band weren't happy with the other, that doesn't really seem to come across. In fact, on the Facebook, Jan Alkema echoed those sentiments in a post. He said, quote, "Now, I'm painfully aware of just how unpopular this album was with a large swathe of the diehard fans, and I get it. Honestly, I understand it. It was nothing like the previous two Amazeballs albums. I especially adore Goosefair. But believe it or not, this tangent we went on with Diskin was entirely intentional. The lads sought me out first to fill the drum stool, no easy task, and as we were getting along, I started to contribute my own tunes and ideas. I absolutely delighted in writing for Adam's voice, which was a force of nature. We also decided on a new way to write. Jam some tunage, record it digitally, then chop it up into bits, reassemble, then learn it and record that, repeat the process if required. The critics got it, except for the NME, naturally." All the other reviews gave us 8 out of 10 across the board. Personally, I think Diskin has aged really, really well. And I totally agree with him. And yeah, he's saying exactly that. They're jamming, they're getting like ideas down, and then they're bastardising it, cutting it up. And I just think it's a really interesting approach. An angle to explain that sudden shift that cropped up in the press at the time was one of a nervous breakdown and an abandoned record that was then cannibalised and recut into this obtuse post-punk thing. Basically, that Adam had heard a new album forming, he felt totally disconnected to it, and so basically cut it up into bits and then reassembled it like a kind of post-punk hostage note. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? That they'd had these tracks that were taking shape and he's just looking at it going, "I don't want to do this anymore," and then just had a freak out, butchered it, and then built this Frankenstein record from it. That was actually, you know, that was kind of what I thought for a long time. It seems a bit too salacious and sexed up with hindsight. But when we spoke to him, Adam actually confirmed to us that a fairer representation was that the sharp turn came from a combination of factors that included dabbling with new technology, sudden new family commitments, acute tour fatigue and mental burnout, as well as just a general eagerness not to retread the past and try and push forward into some new territory. It was a much subtler combination of factors than that one person had a meltdown and just commandeered a Frankenstein's monster. So yeah, that seems to be the genesis of this project. I do think we should probably mention the album art, because frankly it's a bit odd. This giant looming elephant and sparse design. Adam said to us, yeah, we wanted to have a striking image of a bull elephant with, quote, horns front, a stance that portrayed a calm and yet frightening power. And horns front is a bit of a centrepiece here. But let's look at the tracks.
Yeah. Can I just say, one of the things that really struck me about this album when I was listening to it the first time was, it sounds a hell of a lot like Ninja Nails.
Yeah, there is a fair bit of that. I mean,
which I wasn't mad about at all.
No, it's a Trent Reznor approach to production anyway, isn't it?
Totally,
Maybe more that kind of the Fragile era.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So track one, HK, I always assumed that was Hunter Killer, like the Terminator reference. I don't know if it is. I mean, I'm going to ask this a lot, but who the fuck is this? Like, who the fuck is this music? Because this is not fucking China Drum. I mean, right from the start, that beat, the mumbled double vocals, the acoustic guitar, and the weird muddy bursts of saturation. It's the song's really oppressive and quite weirdly sinister. In fact, I think the whole album is weirdly sinister. There's a slow filtered fade up as well in the middle that goes into this big explosion that I think is just masterful. I mean, even just the structure of the song is so far removed from what they had been doing prior.
Yeah, it's a much more post-punky structure in general, isn't it? The general structure of the way the riff, you know, how you've got that weird processed acoustic guitar just in the background quite often. It does sound very late 90s, but I mean, mostly the drums, to be honest, and some of the guitar sounds, but I mean, whatever, that's just is what it is, right? The heavy tone that jumps in does give me, and that combined with the aggressive vocals gives me big Trent Reznor vibes.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that.
I love the decision to go with that acoustic, whether it's a simulated acoustic or a real acoustic. It was just a great shout. Such an interesting texture. The second track, Mamster. Did you notice, by the way, it does a kind of fake out cheery intro? It sounds like it's going to be like, oh, they're going to do a pop punk song.
Yeah.
And then it completely changes and goes into this minor key thing. There's loads of choppy guitar harmonics in this one. I think the guitars often sound just really DI'd, which gives it that sort of later Wire quality as well. There's a line in it. There's a tree going across the river. How wonderful. Like, the lyrics are a lot more obscure. They're a lot more about suggestion and, you know, they're less in your face. And it definitely works in their favour. There's a lot of parts of this record where you can't hear what's being said. And to be honest, I kind of don't want to know what's being said. Not because I think Adam's just intrinsically a bad vocalist. I like that mystique. I like the sort of making up your own words to the sounds thing. There's some really bizarre drum EQs on it as well, the dropouts that really heighten the impact of some of the louder bits.
Yeah, I think to me this sounds more open and rattly. Does that make sense? I weigh a lot of the sort of sinister, less distorted post-punk stuff from various artists kind of have that rattling kind of feel. That's the only way I can describe it. I don't know if that actually makes sense to anybody else, but it does feel as though there is a ghost in the machine almost, if that makes sense, you know? Yeah, the cleaner moments double down on the Nine Inch Nails thing, and I'm going to say that quite a lot. I like Nine Inch Nails, so I mean, it's not a bad thing at all. Yeah, and the DI'd guitars, I think, the only working certain circumstances, right, they definitely work here. Doesn't work for everybody. But it really, really helps in this record to give it that sense of broken machine almost.
Yeah, it's proud of its artificiality. It doesn't try and make these things sound recorded live. The third track, now I noticed on Spotify this is down as Biff Bar. I don't know what the fuck that's all about, because it's Biff Malibu.
Biff Malibu, yeah.
Yeah. Really trippy vocal process loop kind of echoes all the way through this song that I really like. The guitars in it are a bit seasick. They've got this really slow flange and detune effect on them that I think is quite clever. They drop out and then there's a huge fuzzy burst at about 2 minutes 15.
Yeah.
The solo in it is decidedly more minor key and a bit pessimistic, and the tune overall has this slight krauty quality to it. It really reminds me, actually, you mentioned Nottingham, and I think it's pure coincidence, but a band called 6x7 who were from Nottingham and used to do this kind of krauty British alt-rock stuff, and this has a lot of them in it, I think.
The vocal delivery had a kind of grunge quality to me. The chorus did remind me of OK Computer, Radiohead era. It's just something about the guitar tones and the melodic structure. The guitar provides a hook in this song, which I think really helps, because for me this is the first point in the record where the vocals don't really move me at all. Melodically there's not much going on for me at this point, but the guitar provides a really nice hook, so it kind of brings me in. And yeah, when it goes loud around 2:15, it's just a really clever bit of writing.
Yeah. And then the aforementioned track Horns Front, number 4 single from the album. Didn't cause any kind of chart splash, but as a song, I really like it. Most conventional tune so far, I think. I love the false start on the vocal that's in the mix. See, the more you listen to this, the more you'll notice it. Adam started singing too soon, or it's like an earlier take or something, and they've just left the mistake in there. Once you get familiar with the song, you pick up on those little details and they become really close to you. I love that about this. There's also that little technique where just randomly they throw in a double snare at this one bit. It's the kind of thing, I mean, they do it in like Everywhere by Fleetwood Mac. There's just this bit where he adds like a little bit of extra drumming in it, and it just once perfect becomes a hook. You're waiting for it in and of itself. There's a wee melody in the chorus. It's a really thin one. It's hard to tell if it's a guitar or a synth. Which I think just goes to undermine the fucking stupid review of it that said the guitars all sound the same. The chorus is genuinely catchy, so fuck you, Enemy. And the bridge is fucking terrific. I also love that outro refrain. And I've never known what the fuck he's saying. I used to always think he was saying Maria, but he's probably not saying Maria. I probably should have asked him when I had him on the phone.
I like the lumbering rhythm of this. You know, it does feel a bit grungy. Actually, maybe a little bit Smashing Pumpkins-esque.
Yeah.
You know, I think they started to do a lot more electronic feeling stuff as well. You
Absolutely,
know?
That's a good point. Machines and fucking
Machina, the something of God.
That kind of period. Yeah, you're right. It did get a bit more industrial almost.
For me, this song isn't as interesting as the other ones on the record, but it's a single, so I mean, I suppose you're taking less risks with that. The vocal melody actually reminds me of Bowie in some places. Which,
does it?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And see the guitar solo. It's basically a Weezer guitar solo.
Is it?
But it works perfectly right in that point. I don't know why. It's got that hummable, simplistic quality a lot of Weezer guitar solos have, which is a really weird comparison to make, but it works really well. It's a good fit for the song, bizarrely.
The fifth track, Dogpile, does a kind of slight hand with the riff at the start. Like, mm-hmm. you think you've got the one, but the one, it turns out, is elsewhere in the bar. It's a nice wee trick. This song has flavours of the rather ripped album by Sonic Youth in the verse, another previous episode of the show, by the way. Great use of guitar overdubs in this one. The druggy, overlapping, slacker verse vocals are excellent, and there's a bit where they actually cross over into a melodic change mm-hmm. on the guitar and bass that I think it just, it's about 1 minute 20, it just fucking rules that bit. It's really clever writing. The songs don't hang around, they're pretty short. Also, at the end of this tune, I love the distorted sort of Alec Empire style distorted vocal.
Yeah, I was going to say that, that does give me some of that vibe. A lot of the riffs remind me of a band like Ash playing Fugazi.
Well, funnily enough, my first note for the next tune, Diskin, is Techno Fugazi. And I don't mean techno like dance, I mean like a kind of computerized version of Fugazi, that chopped up, cannibalized digital thing. Genius hardcore version this. I mean, it's got a legit hardcore flavour to it. Mm-hmm. Great weird guitar riffs. They mess about with the bar lengths. And at this interval, I just want to say again, who the fuck is this? This is not fucking China Drum, okay? The phrase Diskin, I'm guessing, comes from Dead Skin, because he does say at one point, take your dead skin with you, which is another nice little line as well. Class bit of music. I mean, I fucking love this song. I love the indulgent ending. You know, they, instead of doing just like a sudden stop, they go into this oddball kind of melodic departure, this really fuzzy one. And there's also about a minute and a half of weird saturated drum machine and kind of trippy guitar lines at the end. And it's just so fucking different. It's so different. You're really deep into it at this point.
Yeah, you've already said it, and I'm going to agree with you. The reviewer that was saying that the guitars sound all the same is completely wrong. The crunchy guitars in the verse of this are really cool and really nice tone. That Diskin refrain reminds me of the Breeders.
Yeah, that's a good point. There is a bit of that.
It was really annoying me. I was like, what the fuck is that? It reminds me of a bit of the Breeders and Cannonball specifically. But yeah, that was also a really nice touch, you know.
Funnily enough, you know that there's hints of that in some of those vocal loops earlier on as well.
That's a really, really good song. The next one though,
Reasons.
Yeah.
Another sleight of hand intro at the start. It does that thing where you think you've got it, kind of the count, and the count shifts. Furious fuzzy bass tone in this one. I think it's pretty much straight up fuzzed post-punk. The verses, I think, have a nice addition of detuned guitars that break it up a little bit. And that strange looped fuzzy bass guitar line is the twisted spine of the whole song. Yeah. There's this, you know the one I mean? It's just this weird loop that runs through the whole thing that is an interesting thing to try and build a song around.
Is that like the, I've written here, there's a guitar on the right channel, which is electronically manipulated throughout,
yeah,
which is really nice. The detuned riff, this is my, I'm going to give you my exact thought process, right, when I first heard it. That detuned riff sounds like a new metal riff. I don't know what that's all about. But then there's the two vocals that are harmonised in each channel just before the heavier bit, which is pure Nine Inch Nails. Actually, it sounds like Nine Inch Nails. Which is fine. The structure as well is very Nine Inch Nails.
Do you think we should have got, like, started this again and just said they're a pop punk Nine Inch Nails?
With a bit of fugazi in it.
Yeah. Track 8, Cake. Again,
oh, man.
Who the fuck is this? Like, who
the
fuck is
this? I did not like this song, man.
See, but I think this is up there as a sort of, it's almost like a sacrifice, right? Mm-hmm. This tune is a bit of a palate cleanser. It's a pacer track. And I know, like, bands like the Butthole Surfers used to do tracks like this. We'd have this little oddball vocal sample track in the middle of a record. And you can love it or leave it. But the tune itself is equal parts sort of Sonic Youth, Beck, and then almost Minor Threat vocal. Weird little feature length kind of interlude with a modulated vocal narrative. The vocal sounds like it's been pitch shifted, talking about fat, sweaty asses and stuff like that. And it has some proper punk vocals in the choruses, but it does just serve, whether you like the tune or not, and I can totally understand someone not liking it, how fucking different this album is. You could not see this coming a million miles off.
Absolutely.
If you'd only ever heard the earlier stuff.
That's a good point. I think as a palate cleanser, it does serve that purpose. Like the woozy sections is quite an interesting sonic texture generally on the record.
Yeah.
And I did like that part of it. It's kind of lazy, like Beck, I guess. It feels kind of lazy, yeah. You know, which is a good comparison. But yeah, the sample really annoyed me. It kind of pulled me out of the song, and the guitar tone started to make me feel a bit queasy as well. Which, you know, it's good to react to it, you know. It could just pass you by like a lot of other stuff would.
Yeah, I mean, I'm as much as I love this album, I'm not going to say this is one of the ones I stick on and mosh out. I don't, like, I have no problem with it at all. I quite like some of the ideas on it. When you love the album, then this song fits in fine, because it does give you that little breather, and there's a pretty big ending coming up, you know. Track 9, Go There Today. Really mischievous little guitar line at the start. It's got, I love what they did with the production and the hi-hats. It's a very unusual decision, but there's these clanging hi-hats really, really high up in the mix, which just works. The vocals in this one are totally immersed, really, really deep in the fuzz. There's an ultra stark guitar and bass trade-off. In fact, they occasionally just stop, but let the other one take over. There's a bit in it where he says someone different, and just before he finishes the line, these fuzzy guitars roar in over the top of it, and the vocals drop even further into the mix. And then you've got this bridge that, for the life of me, I mean, it's got a kind of like flanged, kind of almost like dance production on it, but it sounds like Territorial Pissings if it was mixed by The Prodigy. Do you know what I mean? And you want that to explode, and it kind of builds up and builds up like it's going to explode, and then the song just ends. It's like a total postmodern fuck you. Like,
yeah.
We knew what you expected to happen here, and we could do it, and it'll be awesome, but we've decided not to do it. Fuck off. And that's going to become crucial. That decision and my conclusion on this will be relevant, so stick a pin in that.
I was a bit baffled by the clean, surfy guitar tone at the start, but I did like it. It just sounds really out of place, but it kind of, it works in the context
of
the song.
It's so cheeky, though.
Yeah, I love the bass tone on it. It's, yeah, it's dirty bass done right, you know. And when the abrasive guitars come in the heavier sections, both the tones just sit really nicely together, you know. And it gives it this not heavy, but like just horrible feeling, which I quite liked.
Mm-hmm. Now, track 10, The Beast. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact, for example, that Vicky fucking loves this tune, and this is one of those tunes that I've been proselytising around the world. I'd get this on as many fucking playlists and under as many people's noses as I possibly can. I fucking love this song. Mm-hmm. It is, I mean, initially aptly named because it's the biggest track in a lot of ways on the record. It's the longest, quintessential slacker vocals in it. Has a real kraut rock sort of sense of pace to it, yet it maintains a quite a Sonic Youth slackery vibe as well. The lyrics are largely imperceptible, and I think that really adds to it. You get the odd phrase, you hear Stuck Pig and you hear Switchblade, mm-hmm, things like that that are quite edgy anyway. Then you get a couple of bits that really jump out. There's a phrase in it, feet push off from denial. Do your feet push off from denial, which I think is such a step up from his previous lyricism. Mm-hmm. No offence, mm-hmm, but it's cryptic, it's suggestive, it's vague enough. You can superimpose a lot of your own interpretations on top of it. I just think it's fucking brilliant. A minute 40 into it, and it's only a minute 40 into it, so but you get these really lush vocal kind of ooze,
yeah,
that come in, really beautiful harmony.
Loved that. Yeah.
There's also like a pervasive air of menace that I think's aided by lyrics like "Clear the coast for the big wave," mm-hmm, you know, that kind of sense of dread. 3 minutes and eight, the song really pairs itself right back to this really atonal guitar spanky sound and a kind of mildly hysterical vocal. You know, like falsetto but slightly deranged before this wave of the saturated guitars just crashes in. Pairs it back again, you get this really nasty raspy bass synth, layers begin to add, and then at 5 minutes 15 you've got this gonzo fucking nonsense dropout and an almost Oi style vocal line at that totally filthy ending, like a kind of English pub punk thug vocal at the end. It's fucking totally bizarre songwriting, and I just think it's a mini masterpiece, that tune.
It's a really good song. The guitars or the chord choice at the start reminded me a lot of Nirvana. Maybe the progression, or maybe just choice in general. Yeah. That falsetto vocal we're talking about 140 is really nice. It's a really good touch, and the song itself is quite hypnotic, just generally.
Yeah.
Where a lower vocal comes in, that's when it gives me a lot of Nine Inch Nails feel. And then the guitar tones that I've written here are a bit like Nine Inch Nails meets the Pumpkins.
Uh-huh.
Which is, yeah, not a bad place to be, really.
That's a place a lot of people were at in the '90s.
That's true. I like how this song just has time to breathe. It's quite an urgent record, or maybe not urgent, it's restless, quite a restless,
yes,
album,
yeah,
right? And this is not a restless song. It just takes its time to get to where it's going to go, and that happens to be multiple different destinations. When the outro, when it gets noisier and noisier and noisier, and then comes back down again, and then bring in different layers of guitars and electronics, it reminded me of Killing Joke or Ministry.
Yeah, good.
You know,
Killing Joke's a great reference, yeah.
And then that outro leads really nicely into the energy of the next song.
Yeah, as you were saying about the hypnotic qualities of the beast, I think Hold This Thought While I Lose My Head is just designed to kind of slap you out of that.
Pretty much,
you know
yeah.
what I mean?
Little, reminded me of March of the Pigs by Nine Inch Nails.
It's got that kind of like nihilistic fucking feral vibe to it, doesn't it? It's like an anti-palate cleanser. It's designed to fuck up your palate. Yeah, and another really kind of hardcore punk vocal ending. Like, this is simultaneously their most electronic and experimental, but their heaviest album by quite some measure.
Definitely.
Yeah. And then the 12th track, Beautiful Lifto. Totally fucking bizarre name. Always reminded me of the song Sunday by Sonic Youth from Thousand Leaves, partly due to the tones, partly because of the pacing. Takes its sweet fucking time, and I like that. Maybe needs more Macaulay Culkin, but you know what you're going to do. Krauty again, but a bit more melodic, a bit hypnotic. I think it's a great closer. And again, it's a song that has something kind of pervasively cynical, bordering on a kind of nihilism throughout it. It's not heavy-handedly trying to be sinister, but it manages to be a little bit uneasy.
Yeah. Again, I felt the guitar tone and chord progression, just those two chords, were quite Nirvana-y. Really nice production trick on it, though. When you move to the second chord, it bends, the chord itself bends, and it's really, really subtle.
Yeah.
I had my good headphones on when I was listening to it before, like earlier on, and I was like, oh shit, I need to take note of that, because I don't know if he's bending it with like his hand or if it's like a production choice, but it's just in that second chord, it's pretty cool. They kind of bring in the noise quite slowly, and it starts to feel quite apocalyptic, I think, but then they bring it back down to one guitar again, which is clever. And then towards the end, the vocal gives me a big Billy Corgan vibes, but obviously not as high.
Fuck me, aye, careful. Yeah.
But I like that, so.
I mean, and for us, that is the end of the album. As I think I mentioned earlier on, Diskin was issued in Japan with additional tracks. The song Water that had been on that Too Pure single, a track called Bull Bar, and a track called Among Us. All of which are actually really good. Bull Bar in particular, which was also, I think, the B-side to Horn's front single, is very good. Adam actually said that track Bull Bar is probably my favourite of the entire Diskin era. I think it was a B-side used in one of the singles, and when I asked him why didn't they make the record, he just said it was a combination of preference and record company. It was a difficult choice. I would have preferred it on the album. But yeah, and I mean, with this record, the other thing that I think we have to mention is that the album was followed by this rather strange partnership supporting suicidal tendencies on tour. I think many people around the album, especially people that felt like they'd lost their way or whatever, saw that as further evidence of a confused identity and maybe even a kind of professional misstep. I am surprised at the pairing. China Drum at this point seemed like they would have been far better alongside, even like Pitch Shifter or something like that, you know, these kind of open-minded alternative acts that were trying to modernise their sounds and do interesting things. He did say, though, we had a great time with them, but we...
You would do suicidal tendencies.
Yeah, well, he said they also had, quote, full bore tour fever with loads of, like, laughing faces after it, which I think means we were fucked. Looking at this record, as I said, this is one of the ones that I always had in the back of my mind for this podcast. I'm glad to be able to pull the trigger on it. It is, to use the word again, a total departure. I actually appreciate the fact that the band changed the name. It does keep this record more distinct. It's weird going to like the Spotify. You look up Diskin or the drum, you have to look up Diskin, I think, to get it. It's one name, one album, discography, one album, that's it. It's like a really distinct thing. Mm-hmm. We did this one thing. There's no singles, there's no remixes. Fucking one album. I quite like that. It's more anomalous. It's a good band. They were, China Drum were a good band, taking a gamble that was divisive to the extent that, I mean, it contributed to almost more than a decade of absence. Not by itself, there were more circumstances involved than that, but it's certainly the weird reception and the weird direction and the sense of where do we go now must have played a part in that. To me, it's a great example of how taking risks can produce something really enduring and special, because as I said, I'm afraid I don't think the other two records have a timelessness to them the way this does. It's the only drum related album, China or the drum related album, that appeals to musos. I mean, whether you want musos in your audience or not, you know, I'm sure a lot of the punks don't want musos at the shows, but it just does. It's got so much going on, and it's, you know, if you're a production geek, it's got a lot going on in that respect as well. It gave some really interesting insight into the mind and the influences of a band that were kind of otherwise too easily dismissed as pop punk or Brit rock, I think. And so it's pretty valuable, whether it's your favourite record by them or not, in terms of making them a band that had a bit more depth to them. Nobody says that about Three Colours Red. I mean, nobody fucking talks about Three Colours Red now, full stop, anyway. But nobody says that about them. Nobody says, oh, they were a band that had some really big ideas and tried some interesting shit, because they didn't. It's inspiring to me in terms of production and boldness. It actually puts me in the same kind of mental place as people like Millionaire, who had a similar sort of deconstructed approach to guitar rock and alternative pop and stuff like that. Without doubt, it's one of the most enduring records I own. I probably listen to this more than Nirvana, which is the band I was sort of famously fucking satirized for by all my friends for fucking decades. And yeah, I guess much of what I bought and listened to at that age seems quite naive and trite. This album never has. I don't get a beamer when I put it on. In fact, I quite like putting it on to fuck with, what is that? You know what I mean? It's really interesting. You can't tell when it's from. Going back to just a couple of comments I made about the weird kind of nihilism that surrounds it, and some of the lore that sprang up about it, was there a nervous breakdown? Did they just hate each other? Blah blah blah. Because it does have this weird atmosphere of cynicism and nihilism. They don't seem like nihilistic guys. They seem like really gregarious, likable folk. Actually, really outgoing and friendly and down to earth. But there is a real sense of cynicism that runs through this. It's fertile territory for kind of those theories to spring up. There's disaffection in there. There's even disregard for convention. It's like at times, such as the ending of that tune, they could have just played to the crowd and said, here's that big ending that you want. But they were like, nah, fuck off. You're not getting it. Here's the next tune. Here's a weird bit. Here's like a minute and a half fade out. And like, these are all things you do if you're not playing the game. And at this point, given that they were a band that seemed quite comfortable playing the game, suddenly they seemed like they were snubbing it. And maybe that's why people kind of were like, there must be something wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I just think it's special. It's really timeless to me. It's really enduring. And I fucking absolutely think we should give as much credit as possible to anyone that's as willing to take as big a risk as this with their career. Because whether or not you think it worked, it's commendable that they at least attempted it.
Yeah, I don't really know what I could add to that. I think for me, it wasn't what I was expecting, because people who listen to this podcast know my process as I kind of start. I listen to everything apart from the album we're doing until the last, to make that the last thing, just so I can put everything in context. And this is the last thing they did for a very long time, and it doesn't sound like them at all, really. Especially now, because they sound a lot closer to what to their first two records than this. I like that it exists, and it exists in the place it does. I like that they did it. I like that they took a risk to do it, and also quite enjoy how out of the blue it is for them, you know. I love that kind of shit. It's one of the reasons why, again, this is going to be a weird comparison again, but it's one of the reasons why I think the Holy Bible stands out for a lot of Mannix fans.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost the opposite though, right? Because that's seen as one of their best records because it sounds so drastically different from everything they did before and much of what they've done since.
Yeah.
And there's actually probably some shared DNA and approach to this and that, to be honest, as well, now that I think about it. And I like that. You know, I like it when bands do that. And it sucks when it doesn't pay off for them critically or commercially, or I guess with their fans, I suppose, in this instance, because it paid off for them critically, it seemed. Yeah, I thought it was a thrilling record to listen to, and wasn't what I was expecting at all, and I like that. I like it when I get thrown a total curveball, because I was a bit, when I heard the first two albums, I was like, where are we going to go here? You know? where's this taking me? Because I don't know if I'm going to be on board with this. Yeah, good job for them for doing this, and hopefully they're proud of it still, and proud of the legacy that it's left, you know? It's aged the best of all their albums, so.
Nice. All right. Well, I'm really pleased that we finally got to do it. And thanks to Adam, if you are listening, for helping us clear up some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what's next?
Yeah, the Nexus.
The Nexus.
A complicated series of connections between different things.
So, the Nexus, where we take a suggestion from a member of the audience and try and join this week's band to that suggestion in as many entertaining steps as we can, or sometimes in as few steps as we can of your mark.
Mm-hmm.
The Nexus this week is Dr. Emmanuel Bronner, as chosen by Catalyze on Twitter.
Soap maker.
Was Emmanuel even a doctor? I think the jury's out on that. Emmanuel or Emil Bronner, head of Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps, a fairly inspirational American company selling soaps sporting motivational messages and founded on the basis of a belief in the good in humanity, the innate good in humanity, which is particularly commendable given that Bronner had fled Germany in the 30s during the rise of the Nazis, and he unsuccessfully tried to convince his parents to join him in the States, which they didn't. Their company in Germany was seized by the authorities and they died in Auschwitz. Bronner's last contact with him was apparently a redacted postcard that said only, "You were right, your loving father." Fucking brutal.
Oofed.
Yep. Emmanuel Bronner, Emil Bronner, thanks Catalyze. I will go first. Chain of Drum covered the Rupert Bear theme tune. Fuck knows what that sounds like. Rupert and the Frog Song is a short animated film from 1984 written by Paul McCartney.
Oh.
A detail I didn't actually know. And includes the track "We All Stand Together." A detail I didn't know.
Sadly, we all know that.
Paul McCartney was in the fucking Beatles.
He was.
Can you believe it?
Can you believe it?
Of all the folk.
All the people.
They were a famous band. So jammy.
Aye, they were pretty well known, right?
Well, good for him. I'm sure he got in them on merit. In the very late 1990s, the band Low were known for covering the Beatles song "Long, Long, Long" at live shows. Do you know the track "Long, Long, Long"?
I do.
Is it good, good, good?
It's, I mean, I like it. I don't think you would.
Savvy. Alan Sparhawk and Mimi Parker of Low are both practicing Mormons. There's an asterisk against that because especially Alan's Mormon faith has been complicated over the years. He's got an interest in history with the religion, as well as Apache history, with his own mental health, as he freely admits. I came across one story, actually, that I thought I should mention, which we didn't ever mention on the Low episode, which we've done, obviously. And this is about an episode when he was doing drugs, which I think he was a little bit guilty about with regards to his religion. And he says, quote, "I essentially came to the conclusion that there was something cosmic going on, and I was this character in what was about to go on, the end of the world. It had to do with realizing that I was the Antichrist, that I was this lightning rod of what it means to be a flawed man. I closed my eyes and I stopped speaking for a couple of days. I was going to stay there being out in the wilderness where he'd apparently gone with a friend, and wait, because Christ was coming, and I somehow had to exist in the earth for him to exist. So yeah, it was getting really weird, and then my friend dragged me back to town and convinced me to go to hospital. I went in for a while, and then I opened my eyes, started talking again. In many ways, it was the most powerful experience of my life. Unfortunately, it was also crazy."
Well, you know, the Mormons believe that we are living in the end times, so part of that does make sense if you're a Mormon.
Well, I mean, if they've been watching the news, you can't fault them on that. The first Mormon and founder of the Church of Latter-day Saints,
Joseph Smith.
Was Joseph Smith. I mean, I actually didn't do my due diligence there and say, is he the first Mormon? Is there some kind of weird technicality where technically he's not a Mormon, because a Mormon is a follower of Joseph Smith and thus he can't be? But anyway, give us a bit of leeway. We're ringing it.
Brigham Wright might be the first.
Brigham Young, sorry.
Yeah.
No, we didn't really properly check that fact. So, tell you what, if you've got a problem with it, subscribe to the podcast and then we'll listen to your complaint. Aye, bet you we don't hear anything. Right. Joseph Smith had a son,
Joseph Smith Jr.,
called David Hiram Smith. Hiram, of course. That was Joseph's brother's name, yeah. With his first wife, Emma Hale Smith. I say first wife because Joseph Smith is thought to have had up to 40 wives.
Yes, polygamy was a big thing.
Yes, as well as being, quote, sealed to many other women, a few of which were as young as 14. By the way, when I was reading about this, sorry, another deviation, I discovered in the 1840s the age of consent laws in the US put it at between 10 and 12 years, except in Delaware, where it was 7. History is fucked. The world was an awful place, and anybody aspiring to a golden age is a fucking fool, right? So, despite being a fairly successful advocate for the reorganised Church of Latter-day Saints, which was an offshoot, the biggest offshoot, I believe.
That is the biggest offshoot. That is the mainstream, if you can call it that, Mormon church.
Okay, David Hiram Smith suffered from brutal depression. This eventually saw him admitted to Elgin State Mental Hospital in Illinois, where he died 27 years later in fairly abject circumstances. That same hospital was also the site of a daring successful escape by a certain Emanuel Bronner, who fled after a traumatic course of electroshock therapy, which he blamed for his blindness in later life.
Oh, wow, that's a pretty nifty little tie-up there.
There you go.
Another thing I did this over the course of last week, which I probably should have mentioned at the start of the episode, but the Mormon thing has brought it right up my mind, because I just finished it last night, actually. Under the Banner of Heaven.
Fantastic. I've read the book. The book is fucking incredible.
So yeah, the TV series is great. Andrew Garfield was nominated for an Emmy for his performance of as Jebediah Pyrie. Fucking great, man.
You need to read the book. The book is remarkable.
You know the guy who wrote it, Dustin Lance Black, I believe his name is. He wrote the film Milk, about Harvey Milk, and he actually used to be a Mormon, and he left the church because of their views on homosexuality. Quite interesting.
Yeah, well, the author was actually, I believe, John Krakauer.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But yeah, so that guy wrote the screenplay. The book is
TV series, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Amazing. It jumps between different eras.
Yeah, this is the TV series, does the exact same thing.
And it's kind of a whodunit, or a sort of detective show in the modern context.
Yeah, based on a true story as well.
Yeah, incredible. Not entirely flattering to the Mormon religion.
No,
spoiler alert.
They were very outspoken about it when it came out. They've since become a lot more media savvy over the years. You know, the whole thing around the Book of Mormon, they'd obviously learned quite a lot of lessons from everything that happened due to like the media furore around the book.
Yeah.
So they were a lot more open to the critique, and not open, but a lot more accepting of the narrative around it at the time, of the Book of Mormon, the play.
This segment in the book about the Mountain Meadows Massacre is particularly interesting, and it's something that the Mormon Church has had to really try and reckon with.
Cause is that with the Native Americans? And
they posed as Native Americans.
That's in it as well, because I don't know if it is in the book, but in the TV series, like Pyrie's cop buddy is a Native American. Somebody tells Pyrie the story of what happened, and then he's like, actually, no, this is how my granddad told it, and he tells the other version of the story when they just like the one that's in the book.
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting.
Aye. It's also got some interesting insight into exactly why Joseph Smith was killed. It doesn't entirely conform with the way it's taught to Mormons nowadays. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, Under the Banner of Heaven, excellent book. Apparently a good TV show. I've not seen it.
Recommend it, yeah.
Yeah.
So my nexus is actually fairly straightforward, because once I learned about suicidal tendencies and then I looked at Emanuel Bronner's Wikipedia page, I did it in my head before I even actually had to write it down.
Amazing.
So the final tour with the drum was with suicidal tendencies.
As we
just discussed. The current guitar player for suicidal tendencies, as we've also discussed in the podcast, is Ben Wyman, who used to be the guitar player in the Dillinger Escape Plan.
Yep.
The singer in Dillinger Escape Plan was Greg Puciato.
Puciato,
yeah, that guy. In 2011, he appeared as the guest vocalist on the fourth Architects album, The Here and Now. He appears on the last track, Year In, Year Out, Up and Away. His vocal part in it's actually really good. It's the really high-pitched sort of screaming stuff he does, which is like pure, like, nails on a blackboard brilliance. In 2019, Sam Carter was named the UK ambassador, or one of the UK ambassadors, for the Sea Shepherds.
Who the fuck's Sam Carter?
Sam Carter is a singer and architect.
Right, okay.
The Sea Shepherds are a non-profit maritime activism group that was born out of Greenpeace in 1977. The founder was kicked out of Greenpeace because he was too radical on the maritime stuff.
On the maritime stuff.
Yeah,
you heard it here first.
Essentially, yeah, he was basically kicked out because his approach was pretty much the approach the Sea Shepherds have now, which the Greenpeace didn't agree with.
Marrying a dolphin?
No, like, well, they're really, do you know much about the Sea Shepherds? They're really active in anti-whaling. They've got a fleet of vessels which go around the world to sort of help the conservation of endangered sea life, and also they've done a lot of work anti-whaling in various parts of the world as well, like ramming, like whaling ships and stuff like that.
Can you, for the record, categorically rule out that any Sea Shepherds have married a dolphin?
No.
You heard that here first as well.
Yeah. In 2017, Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps, the company which he created, donated a vessel to the Sea Shepherds called the MV Emanuel Bronner.
Was it a good vessel?
It was a 1970s German vessel. A lot of these vessels are old because, you know, they're decommissioned and bought. So I believe it's a 1970s German vessel, but they're big fucking boats. The Sea Shepherds have a lot of big boats, man. Because they like to fuck up other boats.
If you're going to be ramming it into whaling ships, then yeah, probably need to.
Interesting thing about the Sea Shepherds, a lot of the
it's not a quote that people expected.
Yeah. Obviously, like, Mexico is quite close to California in terms of
like it's joined onto it.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So apparently the Mexican government actually rely on the Sea Shepherds ships to actually cut a lot of the fishing nets, because they're obviously against it, but the US government are for it, and the Sea Shepherds, because they're trying to save the sea life, just like go around and just cut the nets. Pretty badass.
Go on yourself.
And a lot of bands, a lot of musicians, and a lot of actors are actually affiliated with the Sea Shepherds, which is pretty cool. I first came across them because I think it was at a Rise Against show, and they had a Sea Shepherd stall at the back, because they're all vegan and straight edge and stuff like that, you know. So yeah.
And if you're a Sea Shepherd and you are married to a dolphin, then we, Unsung Podcast, wish you both the best.
You'd like to hear your story.
You know what other story I'd like to hear?
What's that?
Why the fuck 3 or 4 months ago did we say we were going to do an episode about Lil Kim that we never did?
Because one of the people that were going to do it decided they didn't want to do it.
Bottled it.
Yeah, it's pretty much. Pretty much. And I think we discussed soon after that it was bottled, we brought it up in the podcast, and it's worth saying again is that we did not want to do this episode without having a woman.
We took a survey. We were like, what do you guys think about two cis white males doing a podcast about Lil Kim and sexuality in hip hop? And everybody responded, So
that was an internal veto between both of us, to be honest.
We've managed to finally mix up the chromosomes and get somebody with proper academic qualifications in for an episode regarding Lil Kim. And what's the album?
It's Hardcore. Hard Space Core.
Hard Space Core.
Yeah.
And we will be joined by Marissa Andrevik, coming back after her controversial turn for Brand New.
This is going to be controversial in a different kind of way.
She was quite the hit, so she clearly doesn't mind taking chances with her reputation.
Yeah. I think, you know, I can take or leave a lot of Lil Kim stuff, but I think she's an important artist to talk about, and this record was literally a lot of men eye-opening at the time, because I don't want to do any spoilers, but you know all the shit that gangster rap talks about, the way they speak about women? This is a woman talking about men in that way. People weren't ready for that shit back in 1995. I don't think they probably still aren't, to be honest.
Yeah,
but
I'm not.
Yeah.
But yeah, we don't even need to draw a nexus either, because way back when we teased that we were going to do that episode, we did draw a nexus, and it was courtesy of Craig, and it was Burke from the show Trapdoor.
Okay.
So we're going to nexus Lil Kim to Burke from Trapdoor, and that is definitely going to happen this time.
Yes.
Barring nuclear conflict.
Yeah. Fuck.
Yeah. So we will see you for that. And again, even if you're not a Sea Shepherd and you've married the dolphin, tell us your story. Get in touch.
Yeah. But our new podcast is basically Radiolab with animals and bestiality, so get in touch.
Bye.
Bye.
Save big money at Menards. Add comfort to your life with Menards' great selection of Serta mattresses. Find the perfect mattress that fits your size and firmness needs. Hurry in today and pick up a Serta Gel memory foam mattress in a box on sale now through May 27. Take control of your comfort with Serta mattresses at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.